This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When people say, well, what good is a toad? You know, my response that I want to say and that I do sometimes say is, well, what good are you? You know, what good are we?
Trained as an ecologist, my guest today on Sea Change Radio uses complexity theory to map spheres of influence and find solutions to any number of problems. Eric Berlow has applied this system's perspective to solve a diverse array of riddles, from stopping the disappearance of the yellow-legged frog in the Sierra Nevada to distilling the core issues in the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. Listen now as this tireless optimist explains how embracing the true complexity of a problem reveals its simplest solution, and why a starfish or a fly or a toad can be the keystone to our ecology's health. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Eric Berlow. He's the founder of True North Labs, as well as an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Eric, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks.
First, tell us about some of the research you've been doing with food webs and how they apply to fixing real-world problems.
Yeah, that's a good question. So for many years, I've been working in ecological systems, just trying to understand the order in nature. Nature's really complex. There's a lot of species that all influence each other in many ways. Like for example, everything has to eat something, and so everything is connected through a food web in some way. And so for many years, I've been working with network scientists and complexity theorists and just people out in the field to try to better understand, like, if one species goes extinct, how does that propagate through a whole ecosystem to affect other species? And what we're learning is that sometimes these complex systems are a lot easier to predict than we thought. And we're starting to apply that to other kinds of problems because essentially, from a systems perspective, an ecosystem is what you could call an influence network, that there's many moving parts, they all interact, and they all influence each other in some way, or potentially influence each other in some way. And so so I'm kind of working started this organization called True North Labs, where we're taking complex problems that have many moving parts and analyzing them as an influence network to try to understand what are the subset of those parts that maybe have the most leverage on the whole system. So an analogy in an ecosystem would be like a keystone species where, you know, if it went extinct, then everything unravels. So for example, I did my PhD in marine ecology, and that was a system where the first ever keystone species was kind of coined, the term was coined and was discovered, and that was a starfish, which lives on the coast of California and Oregon, and that it's a predator in the intertidal. Think of it as like the mountain lion of the tide pools. And by in its activity, if you remove it, the entire diversity of the system changes dramatically because it's a super important predator in the system that eats a species that otherwise takes over. So that would be an example of a keystone species.
It's kind of a cruel irony that the Keystone Pipeline uses this ecology word.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, in complexity theory, if one problem causes many problems, then logically one solution ought to be able to solve many problems, right? Now, how can we apply that to sustainability issues?
A really good example of that is Mono Lake over in the Eastern Sierra. That is this beautiful salt lake in the middle of an otherwise, you know, mountainous desert, and hundreds of species of birds that migrate, you know, north and south from Alaska to Mexico or whatever. They stop there and they breed and they fill up on, they fatten up on shrimp, these small brine shrimp and black flies. And I think like over 80% of all the seagulls in California grew up there, and, you know, as little babies. It's this hugely productive lake. It's like if you were flying over it and you were a bird, it's just this like bullseye of, you know, productivity. And the entire system was unraveling not that long ago because Los Angeles was drawing water, the feeder streams out to bring fresh water down to Los Angeles. And so everything was unraveling, but hundreds of species were being affected. But there was a really, really simple solution that was, you know, hitting the bottleneck of the system, which is that as the main problem was that as the water was, the fresh water wasn't coming in, the water was getting saltier, and the brine shrimp and the black flies that are the base of the food web suddenly were disappearing because they couldn't deal with the salinity. And so the base of the, it's like the whole house of cards was going to fall down. And so it was a really simple problem to solve, which was reduce the salinity, let more water in, reduce the salinity, the brine shrimp and the black flies now can grow, and then everything else has food. And so by identifying the bottleneck of the system, it was a pretty simple one to solve, and they did solve it. It's totally recovering. There is an amazing effort by a bunch of activists in the not that long ago that really turned the policy around and completely saved that whole ecosystem.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with ecologist Eric Berlow. Eric, in your TED Talk in 2010, you say that, quote, "We're discovering in nature that simplicity often lies on the other side of complexity." Let's go beyond the sustainability and environmental world and look at human problems. How does this apply to human interaction in your eyes?
Yeah, that was something that Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., that was his quote. It was basically that I wouldn't give a fig for simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for simplicity on the other side of complexity, which is that we can simplify problems by just ignoring most of it and focusing in on a couple little parts that we think are important, but usually it leads to a lot of unintended consequences, and because we just black box the whole problem. So in some of the food web studies we've done, we've realized that if we want to predict the effect of one species on another, how if one species goes extinct or gets overharvested, how do other species change? That the more myopic that we are, if we just look at those couple species, the more difficult it is to predict. And the more we start to include the whole system and understand the whole system, the easier it is to predict. And that's not just a consequence of, oh, we've taken into account more things and we've modeled more things, and so we're getting more and more accurate. The thing is, it actually, as you take into account more and more things, somehow the behavior of those two entities is easier to predict on their own because you've identified a smaller part of the system that matters most.
Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you're laughing, when you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with ecologist Eric Berlow. So, Eric, can you summarize what you were trying to convey in your 2010 TED conference talk?
In the TED talk, what I tried to do, there was a diagram that the U.S. military had made of the counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. And it basically was a map of General Petraeus's field manual on counterinsurgency, where they took this whole book that was a very integrative view of the problem, where he was really trying to consider all sorts of components that are important to a strategy for counterinsurgency, not just purely military actions. And they tried to map out all those things in terms of what affects what throughout this whole strategy. They came up with this diagram that they presented, and it immediately went viral because it was so complicated and such a big spaghetti diagram of a mess that General McChrystal said at the time, you know, oh, sort of sarcastically, oh, if we solved that, we'd have won this war, you know. And John Stewart sort of mocked it out about how you know, like the crazy complexity of the problem. And so
And it did look overwhelming.
And it did look, it was overwhelming. And
but you viewed this in a different light.
So for me, I was used to kind of thinking about, it looked like a food web to me. And I was like, oh, this is great. Like now finally something I can kind of sink my teeth into, which is I was actually really impressed that they were trying to take an integrative, holistic view of the problem. And so I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. I mean, and the problem was that the way it was presented, there was no order to the spaghetti diagram. And so I took every single piece in there, every node essentially and every arrow, and recoded it up as an actual network, where then in some software that a friend of mine developed, that we could actually visualize it more as an ordered network and then try to understand, okay, if this is your goal, their stated goal was to increase popular support for the Afghan government, and there was almost 100 issues all interconnected that were affecting that, then to ask, well, of those 100 issues, are there some that are more important than others given your goal? And using some basic complexity theory kind of stuff that we've learned from studying ecosystems, I first said, let's identify a sphere of influence around that goal. Of the 99 things that are here, there's, you know, a smaller subset, like maybe 25% of those things that using complexity theory fall within a sphere of influence around that goal. And then of those, over half of them were non-actionable things, that like how harsh was the terrain, something that you can't do anything about. So I filtered those out. And then of the rest, there was a few that were actual military actions, like targeted strikes on Osama bin Laden, for example. And then the vast majority were these non-violent actions that had to do with just fair, transparent economic development or engaging with ethnic rivalries. And what really struck me about that was that I didn't know anything about the problem, and I didn't even understand a lot of the things that were in the diagram. But from the military's own analysis, they were pretty much saying that the most effective strategies were non-military actions, and I thought that was just really fascinating to me. And at the same time, I was a little bit nervous because I don't really know anything about the problem, and I was presenting this to a bigger audience than I thought. And right before me was like Julian Assange from WikiLeaks was speaking right before me. And I was in this, you know, environment that I thought I was getting in over my head. But I got a couple calls from the Pentagon like a week later after my talk posted on TED.com. And they said, wow, you know, we actually were the ones who worked on that problem and you totally nailed it. Like that was actually like a really perceptive distillation of the problem based on, you know, our understanding of it.
And what did you attribute that to, you being able to distill something that you otherwise would have no idea about? Was the methodology sound, or was it your intuition of looking at this and being able to filter out the actionable from the non-actionable?
Yeah, so at this point, it was more the methodology, because I just said, look, my brain can't look at this the way it is and make sense of it. But if I reorder it, sometimes human brains are extremely good at identifying visual patterns. So if you're in a room and you have, there's 100 people there, you can pretty instantly tell the difference between everybody's face and recognize them. And so we have really good visual recognition skills. And so to me, the first challenge was, how do you take that spaghetti diagram, reorder it in a way that our brains can actually look at it and look for patterns? And so that was my first cut at it, was just using the visual power of our brains to see patterns that we otherwise wouldn't see. Once I started playing around with it and having the tools to look at it a bit, Then I used a couple complexity principles to subset the problem a little bit more and then go from there. So let me just describe a bit this one complexity theory principle that was really surprising to us when we were looking at food web dynamics, at how species are all interacting in food webs. And that is that in many complex systems, that if you hit one part of it with a hammer and it's gonna cause a change that then propagates through the system. So you knock a species out or you overharvest it, and then that change affects other species, which affect other species, et cetera. That the magnitude of that impact dampens dramatically with distance from the source. So that you often, imagine an ecosystem with all these species, if they were so sensitive that anytime one species went extinct, that everything else crashed, those systems wouldn't persist, right? Like they just wouldn't, you know, they'd go extinct. And so a lot of these systems have over time developed in a way that if someone gets hit with a hammer in one part, that the power of that impact dampens quickly and it doesn't spread through the whole system right away. And it turns out that that is kind of common in many systems, that we call this correlation decay or dampening of an effect with distance. The flip side of it means that if there's something you want to understand in the system, one node that you care about, one species you want to understand, what regulates its abundance, that you can explain a lot by looking just within 1 degree away, one link away from it, what's feeding into it and what are the influences on it. And so, or maybe 2 degrees at the most. You can also think about, like, in social networks, when people are very interested in now and like how is your behavior influenced through your friends, right? And most of your behavior is influenced by a very immediate circle of friends, not friends that are 5 degrees away. You know, most of your behavior is influenced by a really small clique of friends around you. And you can think about that in many complex systems, that any one thing in there is mostly, not at all, and it's not, I'm just saying on average, influenced by the things right around it. And that's sort of a flip side of this correlation decay kind of principle. So what I don't know is whether all systems fit this, but it seems to be common in many. And so I applied that principle to that problem, assuming that it had these properties, and then use that to funnel down on a subset of the problem. And so we're using that in other situations, like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. We're using that for some other problems, like trying to understand why it is only in the United States, only 20% of the aluminum is recycled, when it should be, it's like a no-brainer that we should be recycling at least 80 to 90% of it, because it's so cheap to do and it's infinitely recyclable and it's so much cheaper than actually getting the aluminum from raw materials. And yet we only recycle 20%. It's a big problem with many moving parts. What's the crux of it, and that could influence change on a big scale? So that's an example of something we're working on. Another would be, we are...
When you say we...
So we being this this new organization that I started called True North Labs, where we're trying to use some complexity theory kind of principles and network mapping to help people map the influence structure of complex problems to find leverage points for social or environmental good. And so that's the key thing there, is that we're really trying to do our best to help out real problems that we care about, that fit with our values of really wanting to do some good in the world. And so another problem, for example, that we've been working on is, as human society, we have needs for energy, food, and water, and those needs kind of conflict. So, and what is the future of our ability to meet at the same time our needs for energy, food, and water as the population is growing and changing and its consumption patterns. And so, for example, if you were going to say, well, let's all go to, you know, biofuel renewables, that could potentially conflict with food production and have a stress there. So there's a lot of interest now in understanding this nexus of stresses between food supply, water supply, and energy supply, and all the moving parts around them, and how do they interact. And so we're trying to understand, of all those things, where might we best apply our creative energy to coming up with some really cool solutions that would have far-reaching consequences.
And one of the keys that you talk about is embracing the complexity, but that's in order to root out the simplicity, simple answer.
So there's a difference between embracing complexity by saying, let's try to model every little piece of this and come up with some model of the system. It's sort of like saying, let's just first at least embrace all of the moving parts, and then ask, what is the minimum we need to know in order to winnow the pile down to a smaller subset of parts that we could really dive into with our creative energy?
One shortcoming I saw in a class that I took around 20 years ago, it was a conflict resolution class at the Kennedy School of Government, where they were you have to break everything down into their 9-step methodology. And the last two steps of the methodology were national interest and then core national interest. So everything has to be winnowed down into your core national interest. But this was very much a Cold War approach, I kept thinking, because it's forgetting the fact that what may be in the U.S.'s core national interest may not be in a planetary interest.
Right.
And as we became the world's only superpower, those became more and more inextricably linked, whether we liked it or not. So we couldn't just say, well, this is really good for us. the U.S. It had to be good for everyone, really. And I think that was removed from that equation. So I remember being frustrated that it wasn't a holistic enough approach.
It's a really good point. And I think like often we forget that it's super important to zoom out first, get the 9,000 foot view, and then zoom back in and iterate on that. And in research all the time, probably the single most important thing that I do or that I'm advising graduate students to do or whatever is you'll be buried in it. You'll get stuck on like a problem. You'll get stuck on what should we do? And the answer is always, well, what's our goal? What's our question here? And what's the bigger question? Because that always determines then what's the detailed decision when you're down in the weeds. And so having that broader view is super important. In the case of sort of like this funneling down strategy onto U.S. core interests, I think the biggest missing thing there is actually not accurately identifying the real goal. And it kind of comes down more to our core national interests are basically human interests in terms of like quality of life and civil rights and, you know, various things like that. And in that case, our human interests are inextricably linked to other things happening in the world, you know, and that though, and having those things be better off helps us no matter what. And as things get like way more globally connected, that's more and more and more true.
Strange when you come to think of it and talk to me, that after all this terra firma was our place to be. Sunburnt by the glare of life, still pain what I can see. Suddenly I hear my intuition start to flee, so I wash it down. Wash it down. Wash it down.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is ecologist Eric Berlow. He is the founder of True North Labs. So relate some of your experiences in Yosemite that you've been working on the last several years to this complexity theory that we've been talking about in terms of political resolution.
Yeah, so there's two areas there that are relevant. One had to do with something that I presented a little bit in that TED Talk, which had to do with collaborating with a friend who does a lot of work on lake ecosystems in the Sierra Nevada, where there's thousands of lakes in the High Sierra that people go camping at every summer, and like I think over 12,000 lakes in the Yosemite, the John Muir Wilderness, Sequoia, Kings Canyon National Parks. It's huge. It's the biggest roadless contiguous wilderness of the lower 48 in this huge area. And the vast majority of those lakes historically never had fish in them, even though now people go there, bring their fishing pole to go hiking and eat trout along the way. And but historically, those places were covered by glaciers. When the glaciers retreated, all these waterfalls, like the famous waterfalls in Yosemite Valley and all that, kept fish from moving upstream. So many of the high altitude lakes were had no fish. And people, you know, for many years, people would come up with buckets and have little fish in them and dump them in the lake to create fish for fishing. And after World War II, many people with the Department of Fish and Game came in, and they would start flying over the Sierra Nevada with bombers from World War II and drop fish in lakes just to colonize the lakes, seed the lakes with fish so people could go fishing. But then somebody started noticing that a species of frog was going extinct. It's the mountain yellow-legged frog that only lives in the Sierra Nevada, and it was just rapidly disappearing. And somebody started putting two and two together, thinking, well, maybe these fish are actually they're not native. Some of them are like European trout, etc. They've never been in the system before, and maybe they're actually just killing off the tadpoles of this this amphibian. A good friend of mine did some amazing work where they said, well, you know what, we're just gonna like do some science here and show you what's going on. And he surveyed with his crews like at least 7,000 lakes throughout the Sierra Nevada for this amphibian and sample all the species and the presence of fish, etc. And then showed clearly that these fish were gobbling up the tadpoles of the yellow-legged frog and driving it to extinction. Then the work that we collaborated on was then we said, well, what is happening to the whole system? And we got lists of all the species that live in these lakes and that from their sampling, and then connected who eats who and created food webs for all the lakes with fish, without fish, etc., and realized that the introduction of this one fish was having really widespread impacts on the entire lake ecosystem, because it would pretty much eat anything that was visible, that was big enough to that it could see and eat. And it was a really big, strong generalist predator. And so we did a really fun project where we kind of documented what are the systemic effects of trout on this on the entire lake ecosystem, and how they're dramatically simplifying the food web, not just killing off toads, but killing off other things that ate frogs, like garter snakes that were in the meadows. There's birds around the meadows that nest and they feed on insects that emerge from the lakes, and those birds were having less insects to eat because those insects were being eaten by fish when they were larvae in the lake. All sorts of interesting cascading consequences. And one of the things that's really neat from that work is that they stopped stocking fish in High Sierra Lakes, and for the first time ever, the California Department of Fish and Game and other agencies have actually been removing fish from lakes to try to restore the system and identify, you know, areas where if you remove them, other fish could not colonize back in from the outside to restore it. And
so they're trying to like reset the system to its pre-human days almost.
Yeah. And there are many species that we're trying to save. Like I also work on another project on Yosemite toads, which are thought to be in serious decline and threatened in the park. Those species don't, if they went extinct, they may not have cascading effects on the whole system. So some of those species, if they're there, they're indicators that an entire system beneath them is healthy. So if you've got, you know, wolves living there, it means that the whole system beneath it is healthy enough to support a whole population of wolves. And so there's different kinds of species we think of in conservation. Some are ones that are holding the whole system together. If they disappear, like the brine shrimp and the black flies in Mono Lake, if they disappear, everything else crumbles.
But there's other ones that are more of a litmus test. So it
exactly,
be like,
litmus test, an indicator, a canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, so the canary, we're not really worried about that canary in the coal mine. It's not a problem with canaries, but if the canary can't make it in the coal mine, a lot of things can't make it in the coal mine. That's kind of the point.
Exactly. And for us, if those systems, those lake systems and those alpine meadow systems where the Yosemite toads breed in Yosemite, if they're healthy, then guess what? The water that we just drank from your faucet is healthy too, because a third of Yosemite Park drains into Hetch Hetchy, which feeds most of San Francisco with water. And that water is so clean because literally coming from Yosemite National Park, that water is so clean that it's one of the few reservoirs that doesn't even really have to heavily treat the water. They filter it a little bit, but it's not really treated.
So that's how you respond to somebody who's complaining that we're costing jobs because of trying to save a spotted owl or something like that. It's not just the spotted owl. It's us, really.
It's our life support system, yeah, that we're saving. And the other part of that argument, that when people say, well, what good is a toad? You know, my response that I want to say, and that I do sometimes say, is, well, what good are you? You know, what good are we in that case? And the question is, these species are just living beings that have living entities that have a right to exist and that create this special world out there that has no necessarily, you know, market value. Some of it does. It provides services for us, healthy water, you know, streams, whatever, filtration of water. But they just have a right to exist. And we're no more important than anything else, whether it's a toad or a frog.
Ecologist Eric Berlo, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Diodata, Louis Armstrong, and Alex Wise.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.